Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, listeners. This episode is sponsored by iTalki. If you're looking for one-to-one lessons with a one-to-one teacher to improve your fluency, your speaking skills, and any other aspect of your English, then iTalki can definitely help you. It's really convenient. They have loads and loads of teachers to choose from. It's a very professional service, and it's great because ultimately you just end up having English lessons from the comfort of your own home, and you don't have to go out or mess around with like getting cash out so you can pay the teacher. It's all done through the iTalki platform. And remember, when you buy some talking time, iTalki will send you a voucher for a free lesson. To get that offer, you need to go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website to get started. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. This is the Rick Thompson Report with Rick Thompson. Hello, listeners. Welcome to this new episode of the podcast, which I think is episode 598. And my dad's back on the podcast today to talk about recent things happening in the news, including political things, especially Brexit. We call these episodes the Rick Thompson Report. The last one of these was a few months ago when Theresa May was attempting to get support from all the MPs in Parliament for the Brexit deal that she'd managed to negotiate with EU leaders. But each time she asked Parliament to accept her deal, they voted against it, mainly due to the complications with the Northern Irish backstop. That's what we were talking about before. The date then for Brexit was pushed back to the 31st of October this year. That's Halloween, of course. Subject to an agreement with the EU that the UK would take part in the EU elections to choose members of the European Parliament. That election happened last week across Europe, and the results are now in. Also, listeners, you must have seen in the news that our Prime Minister, Theresa May, resigned as Prime Minister last week too, to be replaced by a new Prime Minister in July, I think. So what's going on? What were the results of the European elections? Why did Theresa May step down? Who might replace her? And what does this all mean for the future of the UK and Europe? This is what we're going to talk about. My dad's with me now. No pressure, Dad.
Hello, Luke. How are you in that Europe over there?
Doing fine today, thank you.
So, yeah, you just want to cover all that, do you?
Just that.
Okay, fine.
Just everything. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Anxious about what's been going on here over the Brexit debacle, and we're going to have a new Prime Minister at some point.
Yeah. Yes, interesting times. We have to start with a weather report on the Rick Thompson Report. How's the weather today, Dad?
The weather today is spring-like. There are some showers, but otherwise it's quite sunny and warm, and the garden is looking lovely. All the roses are out.
Lovely. Showers, so typically English.
Yes, yes. In the springtime, and we're just moving into summer now, but it has been dry. We're quite welcome to have a few showers around.
Good for the garden.
Yep.
Right then, so what's been going on then, Dad? What on earth has been going on?
Okay. Well, the European election results weren't entirely unexpected. There'd been a lot of prediction that the main party blocs would reduce their number of MEPs, and nationalist parties in certain areas are doing pretty well. Also other parties. I mean, it's been more of a fragmentation. And in some ways, the British result was not untypical. The same kind of thing happened here, but for a different reason. For the overwhelming reason was being whether you're in favour of or against Brexit.
That's the story at home, but across Europe, Britain is, nationalist parties did well. That seems to be an overall trend across Europe this year. Quickly though, what are, in fact, the European elections? What is the EU Parliament?
The Parliament is, it sits both in Strasbourg in plenary session and in Brussels. There are two chambers. Which is a bit extravagant, but there you have it.
It's the same people sitting in the two chambers. They just sometimes they're in Strasbourg, sometimes they're in Brussels.
Yeah, they have a 4-day session nearly every month in Strasbourg, where they take votes or legislate on things. And in Brussels, they call them mini plenaries. They have 2-day sessions there, and that's basically as a convenience. Brussels has become the centre of everything European, and trekking off to Strasbourg doesn't suit some of the MEPs. But it's 751, I think, MEPs at the moment. If and when Britain leaves, there will be 73 fewer. Mm-hmm. No, that's not true. They'll reallocate some of the seats, reducing the number overall, and some of the seats won't be filled. So it's quite a big parliament, and it's... Used to be, in the old days, the European Parliament was regarded as being a bit of a talking shop. But in successive EU treaties, like the Nice Treaty and others, they gained more power. And now it is a serious legislative body. It has to pass any laws that apply across the 28 member states. And the Parliament also has committees that help to shape those laws, taking expert advice and one thing and another. So it's become much more influential.
Democratically elected, though, of course, but, as we see with the European election. So representatives from all of the member states, 28 member states.
Yes, at the moment.
And so there are MEPs from different regions in each of the 28 states.
Yes, it's a rather... curious voting system. The whole of Europe is carved up into regions, and the regions have party lists. So people are asked to vote for a party, and if party X comes out top, the first name on their list will be an MEP. And then what happens is that they halve that number of votes, and then see who's come second.
So how can I do this?
Let's imagine that there are three parties, X, Y, and Z.
Okay.
Okay, and they have lists of potential MEPs. And if party X got 10 votes and was the top, the highest number of votes.
Not many people voted.
then the first on the list is an MEP.
Okay.
Then the 10 votes are cut in half to 5. And if they still are the top party, another one on that list gets in. But if they're not, the next person who is top, so party Y got 8 votes, their first person on the list will get
in. So the winning...
It's proportional representation, and it's done in different ways in different countries.
In our country, the winning party, so they've already got one because they came first,
yeah.
But then their number of votes gets divided in half, only them, and then we see if that makes a difference. If the second party gets more than half of the first party, the second party gets a seat too.
That's right, vote is cut in half, and then we'll see who's top after that.
Okay.
So it goes down like that until you've filled the number of seats. Each region has, it depends on the size of the region. In the region I'm in the middle of England, it's got 7 seats.
So this is different.
But that's the D'Hondt system. He was a mathematician in Belgium who worked out a way of doing proportional representation, which is thought to be very fair. Other countries do it a slightly different way.
Okay. This is different to the first-past-the-post system that we have in the UK's parliamentary, the UK's national general election, which is basically where the party that gets the most votes gets the seat.
That's right. And many people complain about that. They say it's an old-fashioned system. And think of all the people who voted and came second and third. They are not represented at all.
Yeah, for example, if the Conservative Party gets, let's say, 40% as a hypothetical, they get 40%. That becomes one Conservative MP. But in his constituency or her constituency, there might be 60% who didn't vote for that person.
Correct.
Right, so this is the problem.
First past the post is thought to be an unsatisfactory system.
But in this proportional representation system, it's kind of allows for a lot more variety and arguably more representation in the House.
It reflects the views of the voters more accurately.
Okay. All right, then. So that's the system. And how many members of the European Parliament does the UK have?
I think we've got 73.
Okay.
73 MEPs. In Europe as a whole, they, of course, have these party blocks. When the MEPs are elected, and next week they'll start trading between themselves, see who's going to be in what block.
So the blocks, the blocks are like, in a sense, like political parties at
level. They're just blocks of different national political parties. So the biggest party, and has been for some time, is the centre-right European People's Party. This is a European bloc.
Okay.
And Angela Merkel's CDU is in it, and other centre-right parties from other countries are in it. They suffered in this election somewhat. They lost 37 seats. They've still got 180, and they're still the biggest bloc. Mm-hmm. The Socialists and Democrats, S&D, second biggest, they're down 146. The people who did better, across the whole of Europe, are the Liberals, who jumped up from 68 seats to 109, which is a big increase.
One thing, the Liberals then are on the left.
Yeah, they're left of centre, but they're a very centrist party.
Yeah, centre-left.
Yeah, well, they I don't know, some of them would argue that they're not left, but they are a centre party.
Okay.
The Nationalists, who, of course, everybody talks about, particularly in France, where, you know, Marine Le Pen's party actually came first in percentage of the vote, ahead of Macron. They have 58 seats now. Before they had 37.
Okay,
it's an interesting increase, but it's still only 58 out of 751. Other parties that did well were the Greens. They went up from 52 MEPs to 69. Things have fragmented. The big parties, the centre right, centre left, socialists, if you like. They've suffered, and the boat's gone in all sorts of different directions.
So, look, could we say this then, that previously it bulged in the centre, right? If you see what I mean,
yeah,
it kind of bulged in the centre where, like, the centrist parties on the centre right and centre left had the majority, and now the bulge is just slightly smaller than it was before.
Yes, people can look at a map of the European Parliament. It's a hemicycle, you know, like a circle, really.
Yeah.
And they colour in where the blocks are, and you can see that the EPP, the centre-right bloc, is still the biggest, and the socialists are the second biggest. But the others have coloured in much more significantly. And that's the way they sit. They sit in the chamber with the centre parties in the middle and the others going out to the right and left.
Okay, I see. All right, then. So, yeah, the general trend has been that, yeah, the centrists have lost a bit and they've lost to parties on the left and the right.
Yes, the established parties are being eroded by other parties, including the anti-establishment parties, if you like, the more radical ones. Why this is, a lot of people will speculate. Personally, I think that it was the two things coming together in recent years. One was the austerity, which is now 10 years old. We've had a decade since the financial crash where all the governments ran out of money, essentially, and had to impose austerity, which has been broadly unpopular, and particularly amongst the poorer parts of society, and they've got fed up. And the other one was the big immigration phenomenon when, you know, wars in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and in Africa had lots of refugees trying to pour into Europe, and that has fueled nationalist sentiment and anti-immigration feeling.
Okay. All right. What about the UK then? What happened?
Well, what about the UK? Obviously, Brexit has dominated the European election campaign here. And the Brexit Party is only 6 months old. This is the famous Nigel Farage, who invented UKIP, UK Independence Party, a few years ago, and never didn't get any MPs, but sort of frightened the main parties by taking quite a large share of the vote.
Can I just say, sorry, one I've got to fact check something. Alan Sked was the guy who founded it, but Nigel Farage has definitely been the face of UKIP for many years now.
Okay, I'm corrected, but he was certainly the face of UKIP.
Yeah.
He left UKIP. UKIP has kind of dissolved, and he decided that since the government had failed to deliver Brexit, he would reinvent himself as the Brexit Party. Whether it's actually a party or not is contentious.
Why?
Well, it doesn't have a manifesto, and it doesn't seem to have any kind of party machine. So where people are asked to subscribe £25 to be a member of this party, but I don't think they have any membership. They just pay the money. This is probably being contentious, and I should say right now that I'm speaking completely personally on this podcast. I'm not doing a kind of BBC independent analysis. I'm going to tell you what I think.
Yeah.
Because I get upset about some of these things, and I'm going to tell you what I think.
I think it's a common criticism of the Brexit Party, which is one of the things being that they're running for election in the They were running for election in the European Parliament, but they didn't have any manifesto, which is very strange. When it's not just that it's conventional that a party, before they ask people to vote for them, tell people what they plan to do if they get power by issuing a manifesto. That's not just conventional. It's also somehow necessary, don't you think, that in order to say to people, look, if you vote for us, this is what we will do. But the Brexit Party...
Yes, it's absolutely extraordinary.
The Brexit Party, Nigel Farage, really, have said, no, we're not issuing a manifesto. Why? Because other politicians in the past have not kept to their promises. So, well, other people not keeping their promises is not a justification for not even telling people what you're going to do, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, it is ridiculous that when we've got so many serious issues in this country, that somebody can say, vote for me. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. I don't actually have any policies about the health service or, homelessness or transport issues or any other issues that people are concerned with. He said, oh, we'll publish a manifesto after we've got elected. I mean, that's amazing. No, the vote was all about Brexit. And they had a clearly defined message. We voted in a referendum to leave the EU. This was 3 years ago now. We still haven't left. We are the party of Brexit. And that was very clear, simple message. But also the other side have also done quite well in this election.
The other side?
I'm talking about the Remainers, the people who don't want to leave the EU. And remember that there were 48.1% in the referendum voted to remain. And there are the Lib Dems, Liberal Democrats, who were, not doing very well in recent years, have jumped up to gain 16 MEPs because they are Stop Brexit Party. The Greens have got 7 MEPs, and they are we don't want to leave the EU party. The SNP, Scottish National Party, is hostile, very hostile to Brexit. They've got 3 MEPs. And if you look at the way the votes have shared out, if all the Remain parties were combined, it would be level with the Brexit Party.
It reflects
the deep division in the country.
It might even be more.
There's a well-known cephologist, an expert in elections here called Curtis. He says when you look at it all, it's just 50-50. The split in the country remains pretty much as it was in the referendum, and everybody's got polarized. So the government has been a shambles. Theresa May has tried to get a deal which she couldn't get through the Parliament, and the Conservatives have been punished in this election quite extraordinarily. I mean, they've got less than 10% of the vote.
Incredible.
Labour Party haven't done much better because nobody knows whether they want to remain in the EU or not. They're sitting on the fence, and you can't please everybody.
What do you think about that? Do you think, why is Labour so confused?
Well, people say it's because their leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has never liked the EU and is secretly a Brexiter. I think it's just a bit more political than that. A lot of Labour MPs represent constituencies where there were overwhelming votes to leave the EU in that referendum. And they would lose their seats if Labour said, right, we're not going to leave.
Yeah.
So they're caught, really. I think that they're sitting on the fence saying, well, we might have another referendum, or we might not. We want a general election. Hasn't done them any good at all. There's no clarity.
Yeah.
So the people who had an absolutely clear message on Brexit, either we're going to leave no matter what on October the 31st, or we want a second vote and we're confident that people would realise that they should stay in the EU. Those are two clear positions. Labour and Conservatives are all over the place. They are very divided parties.
Okay. Now, since we've got, let's say, more Brexiters in the European Parliament representing us, what difference does this make?
Well, I don't think it makes an awful lot of difference. I mean, there are quite a lot of UKIP MEPs. UKIP's vote has completely collapsed and been replaced by the Brexit Party.
Okay.
So the result in the UK was 29 MEPs from the Brexit Party, 16 Lib Dems, 4 Conservatives, 10 Labour, 7 Green, 3 SNP, 1 Plaid Cymru from Wales. Now, you know, they are part of this nationalist grouping in the Parliament, but it's still a relatively small group.
Yeah.
What it's doing is frightening the Conservative Party. And so all the people who want to be the next prime minister are kind of being a bit Farage-like and saying things like, you know, we must leave no matter what. And this is, to my mind, extremely dangerous because the idea of leaving without any kind of a deal on October the 31st would be extremely damaging for the country in most people's opinion, people who know what they're talking about.
Right. Right, okay.
So we're jumping into the Tory leadership contest here.
Yeah.
But the fact that Brexit have done so well in the European elections means that the Conservatives are saying we have to take that vote back.
Okay.
And the only way they're going to take that vote back is to be very Brexity and say we'll leave no matter what.
So we're now talking about the way that the success of the Brexit Party is changing the way that Conservatives are presenting themselves. But just before we move on to the leadership contest, I just wanted to point out there that the story then, to be clear, the story of the European elections is not huge success for the Brexit Party, although it was a success for them. In fact, the story is successes on the both sides that Remain and Leave, those parties that presented a clear message on that have done well. And the ones in the, let's say the ones in the middle or the traditional parties, Conservative and Labour, have suffered. Labour because they weren't clear about Brexit, and Conservative because they have been presiding over this disastrous period where, Brexit wasn't delivered.
Yes, yeah. The story is, of course, that Brit are triumph for Brexit, the Brexit Party. I mean, they've got many more MEPs than anybody else. The other part of the story is a disaster for the Conservative Party. I mean, their vote collapsed and they are down to 4 MEPs. But as you say, when you look behind those headlines, the growth in support for the Lib Dems and the Greens, it shows that there's still a very strong Remain sentiment across large parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk then about the leadership contest in the Conservative Party. Theresa May stepped down. You must have seen the video footage of her giving her resignation speech, Dad.
Of course I did. I watched it live.
What did you think?
Well, I think she was in a parallel universe. And obviously she spent her 6 minutes saying what a great prime minister she'd been and all the achievements. It was a pretty short list of achievements.
Some of the things she listed as achievements were not really achievements.
No, I agree.
For example, like she talked about Grenfell Tower, which is this tower block in London that burned, that caught fire and burned, and like over 70 people died in the fire. And, you know, arguably one of the reasons why the whole accident happened is because the government hadn't done its job in, you know, making sure that safety standards were being maintained in the building. And it's not just that building, like many other buildings, that people have argued that the government failed to look after the people living in these kinds of places. And then, you know, Theresa May, it just feels so ironic that she's mentioning Grenfell Tower and the way they responded to it as a success.
Incredible. And of course, she herself behaved, you know, not in the right kind of way. She didn't, you know, show any sympathy for the victims, not properly. And she went and congratulated the firemen and then rushed off. And the feeling was that she doesn't have that kind of empathy. She's a very cool woman. And yes, you're right. Grenfell, most people would say, it was a direct product of austerity. That, buildings done on the cheap, local authorities, local councils, not actually, looking after the building regulations properly, and they would argue that they haven't got any money. So not a good thing to mention. And in her resignation speech, obviously at the end, her voice broke because she loves her country and she had a little cry. The best thing you could say about Theresa May's years as Prime Minister was that you feel sorry for her. I mean, that's her legacy as far as I'm concerned.
Not everyone.
She couldn't get the divided House of Commons to agree on any form of Brexit, try as she might. And she didn't have the charisma, she didn't have the vision to find a way through it, and got booted out by her own party. The little cry doesn't do much for me, because before she was the Prime Minister, and I think she was a pretty useless one, is that she was the Home Secretary for many years.
Responsible
for? Presided over many, many things that have damaged people. We've seen poverty, child poverty increased during that period, number of police reduced because of austerity cuts. The hostile environment policy was her response to people's concerns about immigration, make it much, much more difficult for immigrants to, be accepted. And
for example, one of the things she did there was a van that drove around.
The famous van,
The van that drove around communities with a huge message on it that basically said, go home, you're not welcome here.
And it had a picture of handcuffs on it.
Yeah.
This was the Home Secretary. She was a hard right-wing Home Secretary.
So,
and all this stuff about how she's a caring vicar's daughter doesn't do anything for me.
Exactly, yeah. So when you see Theresa May crying, and the story that is in a lot of the papers or on TV and stuff is like, oh, how does she feel? Do you feel sorry for her? A lot of people don't really feel sorry for her, because there have been plenty of tears during her time in office caused by the things that she's done. She didn't cry for them.
I'm speaking personally, Luke.
Yeah, me too.
You and I are obviously agreeing on this. Others might think we're being very harsh and being very cruel. I don't think so. Theresa May certainly tried very, very hard to get Brexit through.
Yeah.
But she hadn't got a hope for various reasons. The point is that she was part of what I believe to be a right-wing conservative government, and happily watch the impact of austerity. And she had actually campaigned, not very effectively, for the Remain side in the referendum. So here she is trying to get us out, not very effectively. No, I don't think she'll go down in history very well. She might be regarded as the worst prime minister in modern times. I would put a second to David Cameron.
Well, again, you said the only thing that you can say for her is that people feel sorry for her. And so, yeah, to an extent, like, she was quite unlucky in that she inherited David Cameron's shit show, let's call it.
Yes, it was what we call a poison chalice. I don't know whether anybody else could have done it better, but nobody could have done it much worse. And the whoever becomes the next Conservative leader and by default becomes the Prime Minister will inherit the same situation.
Yeah.
Nothing's changed. So in these 3 years, the country is still polarized. The MPs at Westminster are totally divided on Brexit. And whoever it is will find they're faced with the same situation.
And there are practical issues that we still haven't found a solution to, like Northern Ireland, which is a huge problem.
Yes, it's interesting that well, it wasn't really talked about much during the referendum campaign. Then again, nobody really understood the issues during the referendum campaign. It was all done on silly slogans like "Take back control."
We've got a lot less control
like
now.
We've lost control. Yeah. The Northern Ireland backstop is still there as an issue. What people listening to this might say, I've forgotten what that is. Basically, there's only one land border between the UK and the EU, and that's in Ireland. And ever since the Good Friday Agreement, there has been an open border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, completely open, and lots of people commute across it, and some people even live across it. There are some farms which have the border running through them. And the idea that you would have to have another border is something that nobody wants. You would almost certainly inspire a new IRA to come up and see border crossings as targets. And it would be a huge step backwards in this difficult peace process. So the answer to that in the negotiations with the EU was to say, okay, well, we'll have some checks between Northern Ireland and mainland Britain, if you like, in the Irish Sea, in between Northern Ireland and England and Scotland. And the Unionist Party, which dominates in Northern Ireland, wouldn't accept that. The DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, because they don't want anything that suggests that Northern Ireland is in any way different from the rest of the United Kingdom, bearing in mind the backdrop that the Republicans there want a united Ireland. So the fact that Theresa May actually took the DUP into some kind of unofficial coalition to get her majority through was a big mistake. So we're now stuck in this situation that we don't know where the border will be. Mm-hmm. And if we have a no-deal Brexit, then that could inspire checks on the island of Ireland, which would be very bad news.
And, we talk about the Good Friday Agreement, which is basically the peace accord that was reached during the 90s. During Tony Blair's government, and the one of the principles of that was that we can only agree peace if the UK government in Parliament doesn't show any preference for one side or the other.
Yes, right? it was a recognition that the Republic of Ireland did have some kind of say about affairs in Northern Ireland. There was a sort of joint council, remembering that there are a lot of Republicans living in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And the peace process was hard won, and it was helped enormously by the fact that both the UK and the Republic of Ireland were in the EU, and not just because of the physical proximity and the trade in a single market, but also because it was an umbrella that united Ireland. But obviously, if we leave the EU, that might not be the case.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's a backstop is still an issue that's going to face everybody. But there are other issues, and there are now eight, as I speak, eight candidates to be the Tory leader, the Conservative leader, and the next Prime Minister. And there probably will be some more. And most of the leading candidates are saying, well, we must leave. We must leave the EU no matter what. And if we can't negotiate a deal with the MPs, if they can't agree a deal, well, we'll just leave anyway. And that'll be on October the 31st. And so, you know, that would be what's called a hard or no deal Brexit, and the Northern Ireland situation would be critical. It's not only that, I think it would catapult Scotland into demanding another independence referendum, because they voted strongly to remain in the EU, and their Scottish National Party is the dominant party in the Scottish Parliament. So it could signal the breakup of the United Kingdom. It's a very serious situation. A no-deal Brexit would be terrible for trade, terrible for investment, awkward for people who need to travel around easily. But it would also have, you know, I think, quite profound implications for the UK as a unit.
Yeah. Great.
Yes, it's good, isn't it? This goes on, and it doesn't get any better.
Can we talk?
So, you want to know about Boris?
Well, yeah, in a second. Like, just briefly, some of my listeners will be thinking, why did Theresa May resign? Because they still don't really know. I mean, we know that she failed to get her Brexit deal through on a number of occasions. Was it three or four times?
It was three times.
Three times she tried and failed. And so basically it was like, right, your time's up on your bike.
The main reason that the Conservative Party told her she had to go and she lost all her support in the cabinet was that that nobody liked the deal. It was trying to please everybody and please nobody. This was a deal negotiated over about 2.5 years and signed off between her and the chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, but she couldn't get it through the House of Commons by miles because the hard Brexiteers weren't going to settle for the backstop and they didn't want us to be in a close trading relationship with the EU. And the Remainers were absolutely insistent that there should be a second referendum at least.
So basically for the hard Brexiters, the deal was not Brexity enough. And for the Remainers, it was too Brexity.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So there you go. And so the Tories were like, right, Theresa, you've had a shot, out. And
yes, they'd been calling for her head for some time. And she'd lost quite a lot of ministers. People kept resigning left, right and centre. I think it was a record number. Was it 29 ministers over her tenure actually resigned?
I can't say the number, but it was certainly a lot. It was like, there were so many that in the end, you're like, oh, you know, what's in the news? Oh, another minister's resigned. Okay, anything interesting? You know. If we talk about the candidates, then you mentioned eight. It could be more as we move forwards. But so who are the front runners?
Okay, well, if you listen to the bookmakers who take bets on these things.
The bookmakers are the ones who offer betting odds.
So yes,
you literally can bet as well. You can place bets on this.
I think you can.
Yeah, you can place bets on almost anything.
I think it might
anything.
Be a bit foolish because in past Conservative leadership elections, the favourite has never won. You have to remember that the way this is decided is extremely weird. I mean, it's very unsatisfactory in my opinion. But this is all done within the Conservative Party. The rest of us don't get any say in who the next Prime Minister is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
The Conservative Party has this system where everybody puts their name forward by a certain date.
Wait, so you say everybody, do you mean every...
Well, the people who want to be considered, who are candidates, they have to get a bit of support. It's no difficult to get support so that they have their nomination, they're nominated.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And there are eight people nominated so far. And the nominations, I think, close on the 10th of June. And then what happens is the MPs have a series of votes and the person who comes bottom, their votes are redistributed. They have another vote then. And the person who comes bottom is eliminated and then they have another vote.
Oh,
this is the MPs, the Conservative Party MPs in Westminster.
So they waste
a series of votes.
How much time are they going to spend doing it?
A lot of time on it. It will go on until mid-July, maybe the second half of July, they'll finally come up with it. But before that, once they've got down to the final two, okay, then the Conservative Party members around the country, the people who are members of the Conservative Party, they have an election on the final two, and that whoever wins that one is the new Conservative leader and Prime Minister.
So what is stopping everyone just joining the Conservative Party in order to influence the outcome?
Well, there's an idea.
Imagine that.
I don't know. They've probably got a rule that says you can't do that. You've got to have been a member for a while, otherwise it would be open to abuse.
Yeah, okay.
And there are, how many members of the Conservative Party are there? Well, they've been losing membership quite a lot during Theresa May's reign. And I think someone said there's 120,000 members of the Conservative Party, maybe less. And if they don't all vote, let's say 100,000 people are going to decide on the final top two candidates who's going to be our prime minister.
So just to be clear, just for the listeners who aren't as familiar with all this stuff.
They're probably all asleep by now.
So there's the in terms of voting for the candidates, the first round of votes, the eliminations, that's done by Conservative MPs. So
MPs.
Elected Conservative politicians who are in the House of Commons. They're the ones who vote at the beginning. And then when they narrow it down to two people, then all of the members of the public who are members of the Conservative Party across the country, those are the ones who vote for the final two. Okay.
Yes.
Do you want to make any predictions or talk about...
Well, I'll tell you what the bookmakers are saying. They make Boris Johnson the favourite.
Yeah.
He is clearly favourite with the members of the Conservative Party around the country, okay? Now, the people who are members of the Conservative Party are kind of committed Conservatives, obviously, and they are, I would say, overwhelmingly to the right of the party, and they think Boris is a tough guy who will tell those Europeans what's what and stop messing about. And they also quite like him because he's a bit of a personality. So the general feeling is if Boris Johnson gets into the final two, he would probably win the members' vote.
Okay.
So there's already a movement going on in Westminster called Stop Boris.
Really?
Where... I'm quoting people who know what they're talking about who report these things from Westminster. And obviously, there are a lot of people who are extremely dismayed at the idea of Boris Johnson being their party leader and the prime minister for a whole number of reasons. And so they will be tactically voting and trying to come up with two candidates who beat him and get into the top two. So the MPs are working out who they should vote for to stop Boris.
Okay.
He's one of them. He's the favourite, according to the bookies.
Can we just make a comment about Boris Johnson? That people will know him because of the way he looks. You know, he's kind of a bit overweight. He's got this messy...
He's changed the way he looks. He's been planning this for a while. He's lost some weight and cut his hair.
So is his hair all neat and tidy now?
No, it's never going to be neat and tidy, but it's not quite as long and messed up like he used to cultivate it.
Right. But the criticisms of Boris Johnson. So, I mean, you know, on the positive side, he's obviously very intelligent, and people say that he's a tough no-nonsense. Does anyone call him no-nonsense? I don't know. But people seem to think that he would be a good, tough negotiator. But what about the criticisms of Boris Johnson?
He's a personality. The criticisms are very, very harsh. I mean, people say he's a liar. He's untrustworthy.
Why do they say that?
Well, during the referendum campaign, the Brexit referendum campaign, he was the man who inspired the big red bus to go around the country, and written on the bus was, £350 million a week goes to the EU, we would spend that money on the National Health Service. Now, it's actually a lie. If you do the net figure, how much we get back in agricultural payments, cohesion funds, and in the rebate, which Margaret Thatcher negotiated, it's actually less than half that amount.
Okay.
And there is a private prosecution going on at the moment. Boris Johnson might even have to appear in court. He might not. But some people have crowdfunded some money, and they are prosecuting him for, I think the phrase is something in public office, abuse of public office.
Let me see.
On that very subject. It's not just the bus. I mean, he was a disastrous foreign minister, foreign secretary for a short while before I think Theresa May sacked him, or did he resign? I can't remember which. I think he was sacked on a number of fronts. Very, very undiplomatic, very ill-informed. And didn't do our reputation abroad any good at all. He shot his mouth off and managed to get a woman who's imprisoned in Iran still imprisoned in Iran, instead of trying to get her out. Uh-huh. Other things, of course, his private life is a mess. He had various affairs, and this is a man who is supposed to be leading, hopes to be leading the Conservative Party, which has always espoused so-called family values. When he was the mayor of London, he didn't do an awful lot. He wasted a lot of money on a vanity project about a green bridge over the Thames, which was never going to happen. Wasted a lot of money. He actually bought some water cannon so that people wouldn't riot. Never used, never would be used, and the cabinet would never agree to them being used. And in the end, they had to be given away. Wasted money. Mm. He's a man of ill judgment. Very, very interested in himself. And people haven't forgotten that when David Cameron called the referendum, everyone was waiting to see which side Boris would campaign on. He had always said, as mayor of London, how important it was for us to be members of the EU. He spoke eloquently about the impact on the city if we left the EU and everything else. And right at the last minute, he announced on his doorstep that he was going to campaign for Leave. The reason for that was that he saw an opening. He thought that if he led the Leave campaign, it might win, and mm-hmm. it did. His reputation is one who's he's interested in only one thing, and that's Boris Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, in summary,
unprincipled, untrustworthy, untruthful. That's the next prime minister.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've wrote in order to try and summarise what people have said about him. At best, he's an entertaining buffoon, and at worst, he's an untrustworthy, self-serving narcissist. And I'm not the first person to use those words, that language. These are words that people do use when they're talking about Boris Johnson.
Inside the Conservative Party, use them quite significant people. So, I mean, if he did become the Prime Minister, I think you'd see yet more defections from the Conservative Party. Some members couldn't stand it, and certainly he'd have difficulty with some of the MPs. He's the favourite, and he is saying, we immediately, Theresa May announced she was resigning. He was, I think, at some conference in Switzerland, paying him a lot of money, I assume, to turn up. And he immediately said, we will leave. Deal or no deal, we will leave. So he's happy to see us leave with no deal, despite the fact that the leaders of industry, the leaders of the city, the financial people, the trade organisations, you know, like the British hauliers, the people who, you know, do lorry transport, and the agriculture people, they all are saying, the last thing in the world we want to do is leave without a deal. We have to have a reasonable departure and have a good relationship with the EU in the future. He's not saying that. He's saying, we'll just leave. And he's not the only one amongst the leadership contenders. So is a guy called Dominic Raab, who for about 5 minutes was the Brexit secretary before he resigned.
There's the famous quote of Dominic Raab, which is where he's talking, you know, doing some kind of speech. And at one point he says, oh, yeah, apparently we actually rely on the Dover-Calais crossing a lot more than I realised. It's like,
I didn't
what do you mean?
How
you
important
how
it was.
How could you not realise how important it was?
This is the one that has 17,000 trucks going through it each day or something.
Yeah.
So there's Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, both who left Theresa May's cabinet. Another one who resigned is called Esther McVeigh. She is another hard Brexiter. And Andrea Leadsom, who what can I say? She was the leader of the Commons. This is the kind of the member of the cabinet with the least important job. You know, she doesn't have a department. And she's another one who thinks we must leave at any cost. And the other four are called Rory Stewart, who's quite a bright young man, Michael Gove, And Jeremy Hunt, who's currently the Foreign Secretary, and Matt Hancock, who I think is the Health Secretary. I lose track. Mm-hmm. And there probably will be some more. If the stop Boris thing is going to happen, I would think that Michael Gove is probably favourite, or Jeremy Hunt.
Oh my God!
Jeremy Hunt probably can't do it because he also campaigned for Remain, and now he's had a conversion. You know, like in the Bible, he saw a shining light on the road and decided he's suddenly a leaver.
Is he the only person in the world who's converted from Remain to Leave?
Yes, I think he probably is, but Boris Johnson got there first. Strange collection. The newspapers are basically saying, what a crowd. Is this the best we could do? No one seems to have any principles and all that. We will wait and see. Whoever becomes the prime minister is going to be saddled with the same problem, and they won't be able to get the House of Commons to agree on anything.
Oh my God. It's almost entertaining in its horror.
Yes, it is horror, yes. And it's also rather dispiriting to think what the rest of the world thinks when they're looking at the UK. Mm. Certainly in Europe, they're completely fed up with all this. And the idea that they'll extend the deadline yet again, I think, is fanciful. I think they've run out of patience. And if it is a no-deal Brexit on October the 31st, I think they'll, as they say, bite the bullet, because it'll affect, people. It'll affect particularly the people we trade with so closely, like the Netherlands and Republic of Ireland and France and Spain. They will be damaged if we have a no-deal Brexit and they don't know what to do with their tomatoes. But the fact is that they've run out of patience and they'll live with it.
Yeah, I see. You're not really in the game of making predictions, but do you have any predictions about Brexit? As far as we can see at this point, it's either Remain or No Deal, isn't it? I mean, but
that's the way it looks at the moment. It's either we crash out or we don't leave at all. And not leaving at all, I think, would require a second referendum. And how we would get to the point where the Commons would vote in a second referendum, I'm not entirely sure. So at the moment, no deal is probably the favourite outcome.
We're not going to have another general election because whoever takes over from Theresa May is not going to make the same mistake that Theresa May did, which was, hey, let's capitalise on our popularity right now and let's have a general election. That's what she did before, the snap general election, and it backfired.
Certainly backfired. Lost her overall majority and went into a coalition with the DUP in Northern Ireland.
Which kind of messed everything up.
It messed things up a lot.
Yeah, the Tories, there's no way they're going to have a general election now.
I think that the only way we'd have a general election if it was forced upon them.
How?
Labour, the opposition party, would call a vote of no confidence in the government, and they'd have to win that by seducing some of the Conservative Party moderates. That several of them left and joined this new group an independent group. Yeah. Called Change. They did badly in the European elections, but there are one or two others that might defect. There may be some people who would abstain. Who knows? It's difficult to see how it would be forced. And you're right, I don't think the new Prime Minister would call an election because the Conservative Party fortunes are pretty low at the moment. There will be calls for whoever it is to legitimise their position. I mean, the opposition parties will all say, well, we didn't vote for you. Nobody voted for you apart from the Tory faithful. So, why don't you have a general election to justify your position? I can't see it happening.
No, neither can I. And also, because the clock is ticking. I mean, let's say July we get our new Prime Minister and the deadline is the 31st of October when we leave. A lot of things would have to happen between then and then for us to remain. For example, there would have to be a vote of no confidence, which would be lost by the government, then a general election, which would have to be won by the Labour Party, I think, or some other remaining... And the Labour Party would have to sort out its views.
It would have to probably go into coalition with the Lib Dems and things like that.
A pro-referendum government would have to take office. Then there would have to be all the administration of a second referendum. And that would be, it would be incredibly important to get it right, to get the right question on the ballot paper, and to have it all secure from cheating and malpractice and all that sort of thing. And then it would have to be agreed that Article 50 would have to be rescinded all before the 31st of October. And this is also during the summer holidays and stuff.
Indeed.
And back to school, the back to school period and all that kind of thing. I mean, I find it very hard to believe that we're going to get to that point.
It's dangerous to predict anything in this saga. It really is. But I think at the moment, reaching October the 31st with no agreement is still entirely possible. As for who the new leader will be, well, I've said that Boris Johnson is the bookmaker's favourite, but if I had £5 to bet on this, I might put it on Michael Gove.
Oh, my goodness.
Could be the least worst.
Well, one thing's for sure, there will be drama as things move towards the 31st of October. The story's not over. There's going to be more stuff happening.
I'm afraid there is.
Oh, my goodness. Watch this space, listeners. I mean, it's going to be an end.
I tell you what, there are one or two sort of good little things about the European elections. First of all, the number of people who voted was quite significantly up. Across Europe, the turnout, I think, was 51%, where it might not sound like a lot, you know, half people don't vote. But in European elections, the voting's never been very strong. And I think it went up. So people are getting more interested. It may be that it was the fringe parties, if you like, the anti-establishment parties who brought their people out to vote. Another one is that some of the parties that have made gains seem to me to be very sensible. It's good to see the Green Party doing well. In some countries, the Greens have had a presence. In other countries, they really haven't. And I think that's probably because of the current climate emergency. There are several environmental emergencies which have popped up kind of in parallel, and they're connected. So there's a biodiversity loss emergency. There's a polluted air pollution emergency.
Wait, sorry, what does the biodiversity loss actually mean?
That's wildlife. It's the fact that, so there was a United Nations report not so long ago, which was very well researched, which talked about the number of species we're losing and how, in the next, 50 years, you might lose half the species on the planet if we continue to do what we're doing. That's regarded as the biodiversity emergency.
Yeah.
Obviously, climate change has now become recognized as being one of the biggest threats to us in the long term. And a lot of young people, like the demonstrators and the school kids on strike, they are showing that they're very, very concerned about it and probably frustrated. The European Union has actually got a good record on environmental action. It has got a number of directives on all these things, air quality, water quality, biodiversity protection, and renewable energy, big switch into renewable energy, ambitious plans. They're spending our money on trying to provoke that to happen. And it's the one area that EU policy is regarded as being leading the world on environmental action. So, you know, the Greens, I think, probably gained a little bit because of that atmosphere. And I think it's quite good that there will be 69 Green MEPs in the new parliament. And that's more than the nationalist parties.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, it's not all bad. And
every cloud has a silver lining.
Every cloud has a silver lining, except over here in the UK. I can't see one at the moment.
Just grey clouds. No silver linings there. So, shall we talk about sport for 5 to 10 minutes at the end?
Oh, I don't know about 5 to 10 minutes.
Go on,
we've been talking
minutes.
A long time.
Go on, then, just...
Well, obviously, there's a lot of sport going on, and it's the UK is at least doing well in the sport.
Well, there's cricket.
But there's cricket. The Cricket World Cup comes around every 4 years. This is the one-day game where each knockout game or round is played in a day, and it's good fun, and it's happening here in the UK. So the World Cup is about to start, and the favourites on recent form are England.
Yay.
So, yay, but there are some very, very good cricket teams. People who are listening to this may say cricket. I must remind you that cricket is the second biggest spectator sport in the world after football.
Thanks, India.
Thank you, India. And Pakistan,
yes,
and Bangladesh,
absolutely,
and South Africa,
and Sri Lanka,
and and Australia,
and New Zealand,
yeah,
and other places,
and some of these teams are really, really good. So it's going to be a close contest.
Okay,
so we've got the World Cup,
yeah,
the football, of course. I think it's everybody must know now that the two European club competitions, English clubs are in the final of both of them, both finalists in both competitions. So we have four English clubs. Coming up on the 1st of June, it's the European Champions League final to be played in Madrid, and it's between Liverpool and Tottenham.
Can you just try and tell us a sort of very brief story of why those two matches were so incredible? I just want to capture it. I just want to capture the amazement of it.
I'm a Liverpool supporter.
Mm-hmm.
I always like the way they play attack and with great flair, and they haven't won a major trophy for a while.
2005?
Something like that. They have a fantastic season. I mean, in any other season, they would have won the Premier League by miles. Unfortunately, there was this team called Manchester City around at the same time, and these two slugged it out to win the Premier League, and Manchester City just won every game in 14 in a row or something, and were unstoppable. And Liverpool played really well, but their consolation is that they get to the European Champions League final. That's a big one. And, of course, in the semi-final, which is a two-leg affair, they had to go off to the mighty Barcelona. And Barcelona played brilliantly, and they won 3-0 in the first leg. So it looks like game over. I mean, if Barcelona scored just one in the second leg back in Liverpool at Anfield, Liverpool would have had to score five to get through.
Five and concede none.
Because on the away goal rule, you know, if Barcelona score one, Liverpool would have to score five.
And concede none.
Well, we must know by now that Liverpool won 4-0.
Yeah.
They stopped them scoring, and they scored the four goals they needed. And, I mean, they were phenomenal. Nobody beats Barcelona 4-0. so to get to the final in that way, I know they were absolutely brilliant. And I was listening on the radio. I wasn't watching it on the TV. I could hardly hear the commentary because of the incredible noise. You know, Anfield's Liverpool crowd are famous for singing. They sang and sang and sang from beginning to end. Incredible.
Yeah, and I think partly it must have been that the Barcelona team got kind of spooked by the crowd, right?
I think they must have been. You know, once Liverpool had scored two, they were getting rattled because, you know, if Liverpool scored another, it went into extra time, penalties, all that kind of stuff. And they must have realised that, hey, this could go all wrong, and started getting nervous. And they lost concentration. Liverpool's fourth goal was brilliant. A young 20-year-old Liverpool fullback was going to, you know, Liverpool had a corner, and he was going to leave the corner for the usual corner taker. And then he suddenly realised that the Barcelona players had got their back to him because they thought the corner wasn't going to get taken yet. And he just turned around and swept the ball into the penalty area, and he got clanged into the net first time by an unmarked player. I mean, it was brilliant.
Because the Barcelona team
they'd lost their concentration. They thought he was leaving the corner for somebody else to take. So they turned their back and started, you know, talking. And he just suddenly turned around and pinged it into the penalty area. And there was... Origi, was it? I can't remember.
Don't know.
Just knocked it in first time. And they suddenly realised they'd lost the European Cup.
Oh, God. Yeah. And Anfield went completely bonkers at that point.
The noise was amazing.
Incredible. emotional.
Anyway,
emotional.
And Tottenham did almost as well.
Yeah.
You know, they in the first leg, they were, you know, looked like they were down and out against Ajax. And they scored the three goals they needed.
In the second half.
In the second half.
Yeah.
So it was great excitement. And the other one is the Europa League. Europa League is not quite as prestigious, but the finalists of the Europa League final coming up on Wednesday will be Chelsea and Arsenal.
Yep.
All London affair.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's... And of course, Man City as well.
Lewis Hamilton is winning all the Grand Prix, remember?
Yeah.
What else are we doing well at? Not tennis.
Not
We're
tennis.
We're no good at tennis.
No. I think that's probably... There must be something else.
So there's a little bit of boasting about how, at least in Brexit land, at least we can play football and cricket.
Yeah. The irony being, of course, that Liverpool, the manager is... Where is he from? Klopp? Is he Dutch?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, he's German.
He's German.
He's German.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, German. And yeah, all the players are from all over the world. And
they're right. All from Liverpool now.
Right. Oh, dear.
Well, Mo Salah. Good Liverpool name.
Oh, yeah, Mo Salah. Salah. I don't know how they say
it. That's
in
a Liverpool accent.
I like Mo.
That's a very good one.
It's Mo from Gaston. Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked a bit about sport. We've done the weather, we've done the news, we've done the sport.
I think that's it.
That's it, isn't it, Luke?
I think so.
Okay, right. Well, I hope your 600th podcast is a really good one coming up soon.
Yeah, no pressure on that at all.
That's great.
600th episode, yeah. I mean, I'm just going to live stream on YouTube and ramble in the way that I normally do. I hope that people...
They're
going
to watch you rambling.
They're going to watch me as well as listen to me, but they'll be able to ask me questions. God knows what kind of questions I'll be getting. I don't know, but I'll just take it as it comes and see what happens. It's going to be interesting. I just hope that we have no technical difficulties because that would be incredibly annoying.
Yes, it would, wouldn't it?
But yeah, it's just going to be fun. I mean, just going to be a laugh just to let people ask me questions and talk to them.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave you now.
Okay, right.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you too, Dad. And let's do goodbye together because that way we can just keep this short and sweet. There's no need for me to say anything else at the end. So, listeners, thank you for your attention all the way through these long episodes. Thank you so much. And leave your comments on the page for the episode. We'd like to know your thoughts and things like that. So feel free to write your thoughts in the comments section. Otherwise, I'll speak to you again in the next episode. My dad will speak to you again at some point in the future when the next thing happens in Brexit land. But for now, it's just time to wish everyone farewell. So do you want to join me in doing that, Dad? Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll speak to you next time. But for now... Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.